Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along to this Sydney Institute tonight, folks. It's a full house, and it's great to have Peter Dutton here on the first occasion. The minister's been involved in politics for a very, very long time. He has a Bachelor of Business from the QUT in Queensland. He was a police officer, a company director and a small business operator, member for Dixon since 2001, held many ministerial posts in the Howard, Abbott and Turnbull governments, and also shadow ministries when the coalition was in opposition. And of course, at the moment, is Minister for the very important cabinet role of Minister for Home Affairs and Minister for Immigration. So the topic tonight is Home Affairs, Our Achievement and a View to the Future. But the Minister has advised me he's happy to take questions on the range of his portfolio. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, Gerard, thank you very much. Thank you all very much for being here tonight. Can I firstly, to Gerard, you and say thank you very much for the work that you've done over a long period of time. Sometimes there's a glib line in a speech to acknowledge decades of work, but the work of the Institute since 1989, and in particular the individual effort both within the Institute but within public debate across Australia and importantly on the ABC as well, Gerard and Anne really have made a significant contribution to public debate in this country. And there is no better time, no more important time for people to step up and to be heard in Australia's public debate. You saw some of our welcoming party at the front steps here. I'm sorry that you had to walk through the protesters. It's a regular event wherever we might travel in the country. And it's a wonderful thing that people on the left can have their say without being infringed upon, without being attacked, without being vilified by people on the right and people of a conservative view in this country. It's an essential part of the political debate. This year for me started when I was trying to have a holiday with my family on the Gold Coast, and there was a raging debate around Victorian law and order issues and Daniel Andrews' denial that there was a problem with African gang violence in Victoria. And I was sure that I had read accounts of people who had been out to restaurants and had been confronted by people who had broken the law, who had followed people home, who had taken keys and stolen cars and the rest of it. And I contributed to that debate because I thought it was an important debate to contribute to. And there was a denial, as if these accounts had been fabricated, as if people had made up that they had been victims of crime. And it was a surreal debate, but it's not an isolated one in modern Australia. And the point that I make is that we need to be heard. We need to make sure that our voice is heard, not just on that topic, but on many, many others. In universities, we don't expect much of the right-wing view to be heard in this country, and that's been the case since I was at university. Others in the audience have been at university, certainly the case in 2018. But we can't allow that disease now to infiltrate boardrooms across the country. And at the moment, that's exactly what is happening. And I think we need to send a call, and a very strong call, to CEOs, to chairs, to shareholders, to stakeholders within companies across the country to say that more than ever, they need to step up and be heard in the public debate today. A generation ago, even a decade ago, many champions of business, CEOs, chairmen of companies publicly listed, were contributing to public debate in a way that they are not today. And when you speak to some high net wealth individuals who might be considering listing their company, proceeding toward an IPO to take their successful company to market, many of them will tell you that they are retreating from doing so because they are concerned about the infiltration of their boards by advocates, shareholder advocates at AGMs, two-strike rules. People are worried about the infiltration of industry super funds onto boards now, and the direction to those boards to take part in all sorts of debates, except for a defence of what we believe in the Liberal Party, in our DNA, at our core, that is that business deserves the opportunity to make profit. It deserves the opportunity to spend its capital as its shareholders direct. It is good to employ people to provide reward for effort. And at the moment, there is a retreat. On some social agendas, CEOs are happy to be out there spruiking a particular side of the debate, but rarely the other side of a debate. We've seen that recently in Australia. But it doesn't stop there. And so the responsibility for all of us on the conservative side of politics now is to make sure that we encourage those business leaders into the debate, because at the moment, the unions, the universities, and now the boardrooms are being dictated with one stream of thought, and it's unhealthy for public debate in this country. So my initial point tonight is to thank the Institute for the work that it does, for the sponsorship of ideas, for the presentation of public policy, both for and against particular issues, and they've done that over decades, and I commend the Institute for that. Now, please, thank you. Now, we meet in the shadow of the federal budget, which has only been handed down a week ago, and I want to come to some detail in that regard in a moment. But many of you would have joined with me and many others last May, only 12 months ago, at the dining room in the old Parliament House to celebrate the 75th anniversary of Sir Robert Menzies' Forgotten People speech. And many of you participated in that discussion. There was a fine rendition by Peter Cousins, a wonderful celebration of the messages within that speech. There are many people that in this budget we have reconnected with who had forgotten about us as a Liberal Party. People who had worked hard, who believed that we had abandoned them when we made changes to superannuation in budgets past. People who believed that we had, as a party, abandoned some of our core principles. But in this budget, we deliver to those with aspiration in our country, young people, people in small businesses, people who want to see reform of our taxation system. And we deliver for those people that wanted to see a Liberal budget that dealt with the debt and deficit that we inherited from the Rudd and Gillard governments. And they rewarded us, I believe, for putting us on a sustainable path back to getting the budget into surplus and starting to pay down that debt. Only a Liberal government could have provided for a situation over recent years where we've taken 140,000 people off welfare and put them into work. That's a raw $2 billion a year save just in terms of the welfare payments. And those people are now contributing tax to our system, not drawing down from other taxpayers to receive their own benefits. Those decisions and many more have underpinned the success of this budget. We have, yes, favourable conditions, but there are many conditions that we have created ourselves over the course of the last 6 years with tough decisions that we've taken in the budget that have provided us with significant support to make positive decisions now and over the forward estimates. In my own portfolio, we've been able to invest some $294 million in aviation security because last July, as many of you will know, there was an attempt by a terrorist cell within Sydney to put an explosive device onto an A380 headed for the Middle East. Had that Etihad A380 fallen out of the sky, not only would we have had 400 or 500 people tragically killed, but the impact would have been in the multi-billions in terms of our economic growth in this country, international students withdrawing because they had thought that our market was a safe place for them to study. We had a look at the aviation security settings across our domestic airports, and we deemed that they were not sufficient enough. So in the $294 million we provide for an additional 140 Australian Federal Police counter-terrorism unit officers to respond to an incident, another 50 officers to collect tactical intelligence to make sure that we can defeat the next attempt to attack, and we know that we've already been able to thwart 14 attempted terrorist attacks in recent years. And it builds on the investment that we've made at our airports to keep Australians safe. Because in this budget, we build faith again, because we deliver economically and we have a credible path to continue to keep Australians safe. We've already stood up counter-terrorism unit officers at our Australian airports. They've conducted over the last 3.5 years some 700,000 real-time assessments. They've offloaded 890 people from planes, and they've been able to recover about $12 million in undisclosed currency. Where that money would have headed, of course, is up to your own imagination, but much of it destined for the hands of ISIL in the Middle East. So we already have a track record of having kept Australians safe. We build on our record in relation to border security. This is an incredibly important equity for the coalition, and it's an equity that will be fiercely discussed at the next election. At the moment, there is a majority within the caucus of the Labor Party who believe that the way forward is to unbundle Operation Sovereign Borders and the success that we've had, and to go back to a Rudd-Gillard model, which would be a disaster. The problem hasn't gone away, even though it might have gone from people's minds in our country. The 50,000 people who came on 800 boats, we're still processing over 20,000 of those people in our country, trying to establish their identification, trying to establish their background, trying to establish whether or not they have a bona fide claim to make. There were 1,200 people who drowned at sea, and we've just stopped, as you're aware, a vessel coming out of Malaysia which had 131 people on board, and the most alarming aspect of that was that it was a steel-hulled vessel marketed as bound either for Australia or for New Zealand, perhaps with no intention ever to get to New Zealand, but nonetheless with the capacity to do so. And had that vessel merely been tracking toward Christmas Island or toward the west coast of Australia, the problem restarts. We turned back 32 boats and we've been able to deal with that scourge, at least for the time being. But we know in calendar 2018 already, in the order of 26,000 people have sought to come by sea across the Mediterranean. In fact, since 2014, there have been almost 1.8 million people that have made that journey across the Mediterranean. And we know that hundreds of people, 600 plus, have already died this calendar year on the Mediterranean. Now, it's incredibly important for us to highlight the success here because the problem hasn't gone away. 14,000 people in Indonesia are waiting to get onto boats now, but they don't believe that they, if they pay their money, that they will successfully arrive in Australia. But had those 32 boats got here, as I believe they would have under a Labor Party government, then we would have seen the hundreds of boats follow. So we need to make sure that we keep Australians conscious of the fact that, yes, we have had success, but that the problem and the people smugglers have not dissolved, and that this issue will be with us for a long period of time. Whilst we've been able to keep our borders secure, I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to deal with many of the criminals who are onshore, who would be here as guests in our country on a tourist visa, people who may have come to work in our country, people who may be visiting for family reasons otherwise. We've been able to cancel the visas of 181 outlaw motorcycle gang members, the biggest distributors of ice and amphetamines in our country. Many regional towns across the country are feeling the impact of that drug, in particular ice, on the young people within that community, wrecking families, wrecking communities. And the fact that we've been able to deal such a significant blow to that distribution network is quite significant. But in addition to that, we've been able to cancel the visas of some 260 paedophiles and people that have committed sexual offences against children and women. And in this budget, we build on that work because we've invested $70 million in a child exploitation centre where we can stare down the threat online, in particular given the cyber threat now, of those messages and of that content of children being sexually abused being conveyed online. And the Australian Federal Police estimate that we will save 200 children in our country each year from being exposed to that dreadful crime. And I think that is a significant outcome in and of itself in this budget. Thank you. There's more that we've done in this portfolio with the stand-up of the Department of Home Affairs. We've brought together many of the agencies, and this has been built on the success of the Home Office in the United Kingdom and in part on the success of the Department of Homeland Security created in the United States post 9/11. But predominantly out of the UK, the model that we've adopted reflects the cabinet process and a similar system of government, of course, as we find in the United Kingdom. But we've been able to bring together, while still retaining their autonomy, independence, we've been able to bring together the Australian Federal Police, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, ASIO, and a number of other agencies, including AUSTRAC, into one portfolio so that we can have coordination across those portfolios, because it gives us the best opportunity to deal with the threats, whether it's in the counter-terrorism space, whether it's in the organised crime space, whether it's in child paedophilia, and we've already seen runs on the board. The cost to our economy each year of organised crime is about $36 billion, and we know that the research indicates that 70% of organised crime in this country is committed offshore. So the global reach, the international reach of our agencies is incredibly important, because if those cells are organising crime and running syndicates from places across Southeast Asia or in Europe or the United States or wherever it might be, we need to have that global footprint, and we do. And the Australian Federal Police has recently appointed, as you may have seen, a new deputy commissioner to deal with transnational organised crime, and that will be a dedicated role, both onshore and offshore, to defeat the scourge of importation of illicit tobacco, for argument's sake, the profits of which end up in organised crime figures' hands, in terrorist cells' hands. So these are very important aspects of the portfolio's work. I want to finish just on a couple of notes, because I think we're almost out of time, Jared, but there are a couple of important points to make. One is that in this portfolio, we have been able to create success over the course of the last several years, because as a government, we've been unified, we've been of one message, and we've been able to stare down a recalcitrant Senate in many aspects. We've been able to build on the migration program. We've been able to bring people in the right way into our country. And there is a debate around immigration in this country. There always has been. There always will be. I was a junior minister in the Howard government. The immigration debate raged in those years, and it has ever since. Our net figure, though, which is projected to be a maximum of 190,000 in terms of the NOM this year, and we won't realise the actual figure, of course, until June 30, that figure is estimated to come in lower than the 190,000. And the concentration for us is not so much on the number, in my judgment, but on the quality of people, making sure that people adhere to our laws, making sure that people live our way of life, making sure that people honour their culture and their customs, but that they adhere to one set of rules in our country. We need to make sure that we put Australians first into jobs, and if those jobs can't be filled by Australians, then the purpose of the migration program is to provide an economic benefit, that is to bring young people in to fill those jobs so that they're paying tax for a long period of time. They are the fundamental underpinnings of the immigration aspect of this portfolio, and they will continue. The settings under the Howard government provided for two-thirds of that program to come in through skilled stream and about one-third coming in through the family stream. Those settings continue today, and it's important for us to remind ourselves of that fact. So, ladies and gentlemen, there are a number of aspects, no doubt, that we can cover during the course of questions, and I'm very happy to take them on whatever topic you care to raise. But thank you very much for being here tonight. Thank you again to the Institute for the work that you do, Jared and Anne in particular. I'm looking forward very much to your analysis, perhaps this Sunday, on Insiders about the bonuses that have been paid to ABC executives and the justification that you've been able to unearth for such generosity with Australian taxpayers' money, but we'll leave that for your analysis. Thank you very much.
I'm sad to say that contributions to Insiders panelists have not increased in 15 years. So it must be going somewhere else. Many thanks for an important topic, and I know you're willing to take questions across the range of your portfolio. As you know, from your own personal experience and your own experience as a senior minister, we've done pretty well on security. I think there's been one death, terrorist-related death. Most of the terrorist instances have been people have been charged and convicted of conspiracy to rather than engaging in. So it would seem that ASIO was working pretty well, the AFP was working pretty well, state police were working pretty well. So what was the kind of rationale to put them together? I know you mentioned the Home Office ideal, but do you think they can work better with ASIO in this broader department, or was there some other reason why you did it?
Well, Jared, as you point out, we've been able to thwart, as I mentioned before, 14 attempted attacks. We're seeing in Indonesia at the moment with attacks in the last 24 or 72 hours in Surabaya and now in Sumatra this afternoon, the reality of the threat that we face. And we deal with it here. We deal with it in Indonesia, and we work very closely with the Indonesians because we have about 1 million Australians who travel to Indonesia each year for holidays, for work, etc. So we need to make sure that we have the greatest capacity to deal with that threat. And while somebody may have been touched by somebody injured or killed in the Bali bombings or on the London Bridge or Borough Markets or in Paris, wherever it may have been, there will be a significant shock to the Australian psyche if and when an attack takes place on our soil. And the reality is that people are trying to mastermind such an attack right now. Inevitably, I believe that a Royal Commission in the aftermath of that attack would find that there had been insufficient sharing of information and intelligence between the agencies. Now, yes, already there is an excellent collaboration between the agencies, but already at a leadership level within the organisation, within Home Affairs, we have seen a greater preparedness to work together to have a better understanding about the work plan ahead, investments in information technology, and many other aspects of the portfolio. So I think we're already seeing dividends within the portfolio. I have no doubt that there would have been a recommendation post, during the course of a coronial inquiry, which would have said we should have worked more effectively together. And frankly, I think it's prudent to preempt that that finding.
Susan?
Minister, a follow-up question to Jared's question. The law enforcement and national security agencies, which are all being amalgamated, have been in situ operating relatively independently for some decades. They all have very unique cultures. How are you going to address the cultural silos to make sure that the department actually achieves the objectives that you're seeking in terms of the proximity?
Well, of course, each of the agencies has a different history. So the Australian Federal Police is relatively new in the scheme of things. ASIO around in different forms, but in its current iteration for a long period of time. Australian Border Force only since July of 2015. The ACIC dates back to the Australian Crime Commission and then back to the NCA before that. So it's a good point in terms of the different cultures that they bring to the table. But we need to make sure that they're retaining their independence, which they do. There is no legislative change around the independence or the executive power of the Australian Federal Police Commissioner or the Director General of ASIO, for example. The agencies haven't been abolished and everybody combined into one agency. That's not how the Home Affairs Department has come together. They've kept their independence and their autonomy, and the constituent parts now form part of the portfolio. So I think it would be a fair criticism if we had a mega department of tens of thousands of people, some of whom were working in ASIO, others who were involved in policing law enforcement activities. But there is already, as I say, through the budget process, the ability to find some savings. I think we ended up with 11 CFOs, and that's the start of it. And to provide those efficiencies then back to frontline services is something, as the Federal Police Commissioner Andrew Colvin has pointed out, I think is a welcome development. So we're not impinging on their independence. There's no direction given by me that is any different to a direction given by a former minister. But I promise you there is the need to work more closely together, to respect the cultures, but nonetheless to recognise that, that there is a greater capacity to work more closely together.
Minister Darren Challis, you opened up with an eloquent plea to suggest, if I understood correct, that those from the commercial sector, chairs and CEOs, should advocate on public issues. I recall last year during the marriage equality debate when 30 CEOs wrote to the Prime Minister advocating, you told them that they should stick to running their businesses. Are you suggesting they should only advocate if they share the views of the right?
No, not at all. And I made the point last year. I thought it was incredibly important for there to be a respectful debate, and CEOs can expend their own money in whatever way they want on a campaign for or against same-sex marriage or whatever the current issue of the day might be. But I drew a line in terms of my own judgment in the use of taxpayers' money for some of those causes. Now, at the moment, you're seeing a debate around profits out of companies, wages being ripped off allegedly from workers, penalty rates being stripped from workers, which is obviously a union campaign. But there is very little pushback on that, very little indeed. And I think it's worrying, because I think it is important for companies to be out there talking about the need for an entrepreneurial spirit to survive in this country. I think it's important for them to talk about the fact that they have employed more staff under better conditions than have ever been present in the history of this nation. I think it's important for them to talk about the opportunities that have come from the free trade agreements and the way that they've been able to explore foreign markets and now export and import. I think it's important for the other side of the story to be told. I would note, though, just going back to your earlier point, had John Borghetti from Virgin been out there on the other side of the marriage debate, I suspect there would have been protests at departure gates around the country. I suspect rainbow flags would have been unfurled on the flights conducted by Virgin. And again, it's an unhelpful, disrespectful debate. And people can express their view. Whether it's consistent with mine or not is completely irrelevant to me. But it needs to be done in a respectful way, and it needs to be done in an informed way. And I think at the moment we have some CEOs who are cowering at the hands of boards and shareholder activists, and I don't believe that that is in our country's best interest. I don't believe it's in the shareholders' best interest, and I would like to see some of those CEOs stand up and provide, particularly in the economic debate, some counter to the propaganda that's being spread at the moment.
Max? Now, folks, we've got plenty of time. Okay. We'll get through it as quickly as we can. We keep your comments and questions short. Okay, here we go.
Minister, you spoke about security, but there is good work has been done, but there is a concern regarding some of the tribunal's decisions, the AAT, which allows some to stay in Australia who could be a threat to our security. Anything to be done about it? Thank you.
Now you might just briefly background that about the Minister of Appeals Tribunal.
Sure. So I spoke before about the visa cancellations that we've conducted. We've worked with the policing agencies to identify their top targets, including those outlaw motorcycle gang members and the pedophiles in addition to that. But we've been able to increase the number of cancellations of people who are here on visas, so non-citizens who have committed offences against Australians. And those numbers are up by about 1,200%. I've cancelled more visas in the last 12 months than Labor did in 6 years in government. And the point you make is in relation to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, which has provided some interesting commentary, overturning of a number of decisions. They can't overturn my decisions, but they can overturn the decisions of delegates within my department making decisions on my behalf. I can then in turn overturn their decision, which seems like quite a cumbersome process. The matter, of course, then in certain circumstances can proceed onto the Federal Court or the full Federal Court or onto the High Court in some circumstances. So we are looking at ways in which we could make the system more efficient. We spend millions of dollars of taxpayers' money each year defending many of these matters. There are some people who list knowing that they have no prospect of success at all, but there's a lot of pro bono support from law firms in the immigration law area. And they do that because people can work, gather money, remit that money back overseas, and perhaps it's 2 or 3 years or more before the matter is finalised, generally not in their favour. So the important point is that there should be judicial review, there must be judicial review, and there must be an analysis of the facts, my decision, which is of course not beyond scrutiny and should be open to discussion within that judicial setting. But there needs to be some end to the process. People deserve their fair day in court. But at the moment, when you look at some of the appointments that were made to the AAT during the Rudd and Gillard years, appointments for 7 years, so some of those people, obviously, the vast majority, we would not reappoint, and we've reappointed, or we've appointed other people in their place. So you'll see, I think, some cultural change and a different approach to some of that decision making. But it is a frustration. It's a frustration for the decision makers, and the frustration really is felt most by the future victims of that particular person who's been allowed to stay in our country. And there are plenty of examples I could cite that I've looked at where people have been given numerous warnings, or the AAT has overturned a decision, the person has gone on to commit more crime. And I think they are the people that we need to bear in mind, the future victims of those individual criminals. And as I say, there needs to be natural justice and a judicial process in place, but it shouldn't be as prolonged and convoluted as it is now.
Question here.
Minister, Louise Waterhouse and the Consul for the Kingdom of Tonga. I very much enjoyed your talk today, and thank you for sharing a lot of the information with us. I'd just like to raise another side of policy of deporting people who have a criminal conviction, because yes, a lot of people who come here are tourists, but a lot of the people, for example, from Tonga, they're actually permanent residents here and who get deported, and they've obviously done the wrong thing, etc. In a country like Tonga, where you only have 100,000 people, we have many hundreds, if not 1,000 people that have been deported, not just from Australia, but from New Zealand and from America. And so I'd like to suggest that maybe there's an opportunity to start a rehabilitation program for the people we know are going to be deported in 2-3 years' time. People we know will be no longer allowed to stay here. Help them to learn the language, help them to learn the skill. So when they go back to the country, they have an opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Louise, I would point out that it's a sovereign right of any nation, Tonga included, to decide whether or not a non-citizen stays in their country or whether that person's deported. And we're not going to surrender that sovereign right. Australians who commit serious crime in Tonga would expect to be deported back to Australia. Some people from island nations find their way through New Zealand, and it may be that they've got New Zealand citizenship as well, or they can avail themselves of New Zealand citizenship. That's an issue for New Zealand as to whether New Zealand would take them back or would accept them. And I think we've sent a very clear message already that if you want to embark upon a life of crime, regardless of what country you've come from, and you're a non-citizen in this country, then we will be embarking on a process to deport you. And I think we welcome millions of people. I mean, my department processed something like 42 million people across our borders last year. We have great people, a great success story in migration in this country, but not in the people that have caused us harm and not in the people that would act outside of the law. We want people to become citizens because they share our values, they abide by our laws, they integrate into our community, they increase their use of English language and the proficiency of the English language, which is important to succeed in education or in work, and they're the values that we set. And if people decide that they want to commit crime, people know the law, and in many cases people are given a second or third chance, particularly through the legal system in this country. For somebody to get 12 months as a sentence in this country, there needs to have been, generally speaking, a history of crime or a seriousness attached to the offence for them to be sentenced to or convicted to a 12-month sentence of imprisonment. So that's our view, and I think it's supported by the majority of Australians.
Question over there. There's a question here.
Minister, you were talking about the figures, the immigration figures of 190,000 this year. Is everybody included that in that? I've been reading in the last few days that New Zealanders aren't included in that. Students who are here on visas and who later become permanent residents are not included on that. Is that right?
So
what is the total figure?
So the net overseas migration figure, the NOM to which I referred earlier, is the indicator. Now, the way in which that's analysed is if somebody's been in our country for 12 out of the last 16 months, or if they've been out of our country for more than 12 months of the last 16, then they're counted within that figure. So it depends really on the circumstance as to whether or not somebody is counted. But if you're a student in this country and you've been studying a course over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, you will be included in that figure. Now, there may be other circumstances where people are here for a shorter stay, for a 3-month period or a 6-month period, and it may be that they're not counted in that figure. So for us, and this is part of the debate at the moment, obviously you've seen some comments by the Prime Minister, myself and others, the task is to try and identify opportunities for people outside of capital cities, because at the moment we've got some regional communities where the abattoir doesn't open without that migrant workforce. People know that are running farms, whether it's beef or sheep, for example, they can't get that product processed without that migrant workforce. Now, there are many aspects to this because you ask yourself the question why Australians aren't prepared to work in that setting, in that job in the first place, which is a whole other debate. It relates back to our welfare reform changes that I made mention of earlier. So that's the composition of that figure, and some people will be in and out of that figure depending on whether they meet the 12 out of 16 months. And some people have the ability to go on to a permanent residency and likely onto citizenship, depending on when they arrived, and others don't. So the abolition of the 457 program that we announced last year, for many people, they will now come under a temporary arrangement, and there's not an automatic, quasi-automatic pathway to citizenship that there once was. So it's a complicated space, but that's the way that we arrive at that figure. And it's projected to be at a ceiling of 190,000 this year.
Question up there. Yep. Got the
microphone. Minister, it's been suggested that conservatism is now the current counterculture. Do you see with the strength that the left has in media and education and in culture as a whole, do you see the Liberal Party having to adapt to continue to have a realistic impact in the future?
Well, my judgment has been shaped, as a case for all of us, by your own experience, including, if I can recall back to John Howard and culture wars and university debates. I remember being at university with John Howard speaking and young liberals holding the doors with the left trying to burst their way into the university lecture theatre to try and drown his voice out. Now, not much has changed, but there is a reluctance for a lot of people on the right to speak up, and I think we need to provide that call and provide it regularly for good people to be heard, because at the moment, as I said before, this has gone beyond universities, which is accepted because it's a place of contested ideas, and it's always been the case that campuses have been dominated by a leftist view, in my judgment. Not all campuses, of course, but people have been able to speak up. I think there is a greater reluctance now. The classic case, in my mind, is the tragedy of the sexual abuse of the children in the Northern Territory or in Indigenous communities otherwise. The fact that the Northern Territory government won't respond, that they've lost control of a situation where it's deemed acceptable for young children, for infants, to be sexually abused and not removed from that community and put into a place of safety. It's inconceivable. And yet, because of cultural reasons, we're told we can't enter into that debate, or the Northern Territory government is unable to act. Now, I think the vast majority of Australians, whether they identify as being on the right or conservative, in their values, they know that that is completely unacceptable. If that happened in one of the suburbs in Sydney or in Brisbane or other states and territories around the country tonight, there would be outrage that that two-year-old or three-year-old child hadn't been removed from that household, and that they face the prospect again tomorrow night of the same abuse. It's completely inconceivable. It's unacceptable and it's inhumane. And I think there is a tipping point, as there was during the Keating years, where people slowly start to get to a boiling point, slowly start to rise up. And I think we're seeing that at the moment. But we can't allow people of significant influence and strong voice, that is, captains of industry, CEOs, chairs and others, to be silent on important matters, particularly economic matters. So I think it's incumbent on those of us in public life where those values are important to speak about it and to speak frankly about it. I think the Australian public wants you to speak in ways that can be easily communicated, properly understood, not veiled in all sorts of messages, and sometimes that gets you into trouble, but I think it's better to be frank about the problems that we face.
Minister, Hawke accused the government of 45,000 Chinese nationals from the residents in Australia because of the Tiananmen massacre in 1989. Now China has become the second economy because of the aid of the West, including Australia. Now China's one side is powerful and growth. Another side of people's complaining it's misrule and horrific human rights violations. Now, the question is, does Australia still considering China as a country of origin to produce people who flee for political persecution? Thank you.
Well, a couple of points. I mean, the important point to make, and the most obvious point to make, is that the contribution of Chinese Australians and people that have come here from the 1800s is significant, and we honour the contribution of Chinese Australians, people with an entrepreneurial spirit, people who work hard, want their children educated, law-abiding, and we have benefited greatly as a country because of Chinese migration to Australia. So we need, though, to call out where there is political interference, as we've seen with Russia in terms of another state actor, where they have sought to influence elections in another country, in a democracy, where there has been infiltration into media, into press, within communities, including in our own country, and we need to call it out. That foreign interference is a significant aspect for us. The cyber attacks from state actors are a significant threat to our system, our banking system, our critical infrastructure, etc. So we have to be honest about the debate. The problem is not with Chinese people, but the problem is with some actors within a government that don't share the same values in terms of democratic freedoms, etc., that we might. To go directly to your question, if somebody faces persecution and they can make a claim out in accord with our international and domestic laws, then we will provide protection to that person. So regardless of their skin colour, I made some comments recently about South African farmers where their wives had been raped or murdered, or their daughters similarly, that we would consider their applications as well. We don't discriminate on the basis of somebody's skin. We're not discriminating against people's religion. We're not discriminating against other aspects. We want to make sure that they can meet all of the criteria that I spoke about before. Work hard, not live a life on welfare if they're of a working age and able to work, integrating into our society, abiding by laws, etc. That's the criteria that we set.
Question up there.
Hello. Look, my name's Katrina Seelig. I'm a migration lawyer. And I was just wondering about what better outcomes you expect to achieve with the abolition of subclass 457 visas any introduction to 482 visas, especially in light of the captains of industry not being very happy with certain occupations not leading to permanent residency and citizenship?
Well, the threshold question here is whether or not we think we need to offer a permanent outcome to somebody to get it to take up a job in our country. And as I said last year, the unapologetic approach that we've taken is that we want Australians into those jobs. I don't want areas of youth unemployment of 25 or 27, 30% unemployment. I want to make sure that we can provide whatever incentive possible to get Australians into those jobs. Now, there are many areas, particularly in regional areas, in remote areas, where Australians won't fill those jobs. Hospitality, et cetera, is one example. Rural sector I spoke about before. And we need to fill those positions with a 457 worker under the old system or different visa categories depending on the skill set. So that's the starting point. I think where we had got to was that many people claimed effectively that, and we're sort of getting into a complicated space, I'm sorry for the to sort of delve too deep for those here that that aren't acquainted with the visa categories, but under the old 457 program, there was the ability to go on to permanent residency, which is essentially a pathway to citizenship. And what we said in the abolition of the 457 program was that if you have to fill that job that can't be filled by an Australian, why do you say that we need to offer citizenship at the end of it? Now, I think we devalue our own status in the world. Australian citizenship is a significant prize. And yes, many of those people who work hard, fill those jobs, go on to become Australian citizens, and we welcome that. But it shouldn't be a pathway that's expected or that's marketed. And we had got to that point with many people. Now, I think we've recalibrated, we've reset, and yes, there were some people within different industries that were upset that we had taken some of the codes off the list, the employment codes off the list, but we've been able to work through that, and we recalibrate that now every 6 months, where we take some off and put some back on, depending on supply and demand within the market. So I think, frankly, we've improved that system significantly, and we've improved the integrity of the system, because if people see rorts within the system, the broader community won't support that program going forward, and it was a fundamental problem that that we had to address.
We're getting close to the end. We've got to be very brief.
I've been asking since the beginning.
Hang on just a minute. We're going here.
Yes. My name is Philip Feinstein. I'm with the organisation Music for Refugees. I want to thank you, actually, for granting us permission to send all the instruments over to Nauru and Manus Island. I believe they have arrived, and I know it's going to help the refugees and the asylum seekers. There is enormous stress. So this is thanks to you, and I hope we'll continue in that vein.
Well, thank you, Philip, very much. And we've obviously, for the work that you do and for supporting people, we're obviously working very hard to get people off Manus and Nauru. We've got the arrangement with the United States. Well over 200 people now have departed Manus and Nauru to go to the United States, and others have left otherwise to go back to their country of origin. So we're working very hard day by day, trying to look at third country options otherwise. I haven't put anyone on Manus or Nauru, but I've closed 17 detention centres here. We've got 8,000 children out of detention, and we don't have new arrivals of boats, which means that we don't have new arrivals on Manus in particular.
There's a question up the back, but you've got to be brief. Yeah.
It will be brief. Thank you for having such a grip on your portfolio. It's a compliment. I can't understand why, when refugees go to Europe and here to Australia, there never seems to be any mention of the repressive countries and the pressures that send them to do such things. Could you just comment on the South African farmers' possibility at being able to accept farmers who will contribute to the country?
Okay, we got it. Right. Yeah.
The reluctance from some of the farmers, even if they've experienced terrible circumstances, will be that their assets aren't liquid. So for some people, they will be particularly concerned about not being able to dispose of a farm, obviously, or to realise money to bring it across to restart their life in our country. But you're right. I mean, people want to work. They want their kids to study and be successful in life. And there's been a good experience of people from Zimbabwe and otherwise in that circumstance before. So we have a number of applications that have been considered at the moment. We will have success in some of those, but the numbers won't be great, but they'll reflect the fact that that there is a problem, and we will have a look at the individual circumstances, and if we can provide support, relief and a new opportunity to those people, then that will happen.
This question here is going to be brief. Behind, pass it back to you.
Yes, I'm Dorothy Hodnock. I think that your government's got a lot of guns on the ball in things like expansion of the humanitarian program and so on. The problem I think that is important remains the unresolved issue of asylum seekers who are living in our community of, you know, about 20,000 people. Would you please explain, in the context of a generally successful program, why the government has now decided to remove support from the majority of asylum seekers to force them into work in situations where many of them are unlikely to find work and will become indigent?
Well, so far, the problems created by Mr. Rudd and Ms. Gillard have cost us about $16 billion. That's quantified so far. And as you say, still with a significant tail in it. Now, we have people that have been found not to be refugees who are living in Australia, and there's no prospect of returning them back to a country like Iran, for example, because Tehran says unless that individual wants to return voluntarily, Tehran will not issue travel documents for that individual. Now, this is a problem in part on Manus and Nauru because people know that we've said they aren't coming to Australia because we don't want boats to restart. And the difficulty is there are no third countries otherwise, particularly if the United States looks at individual cases and says that they won't take those people. So there's a significant amount of support that we provide. But equally, in some cases, we had thousands of people who had refused to lodge their papers for consideration. Now, we had put in place a regime where we said that there would be a termination of support if people didn't file the relevant applications. We saw almost 100% compliance with that, and that process is now underway. But equally, if people have been found not to be refugees, if there are groups that are encouraging people to stay here when they're not entitled to stay, and we've been very clear about the fact that we aren't going to settle people who have arrived off boats, at the same time that this year the numbers will rise to 18,750 under the Refugee and Humanitarian Program, so we're settling people in record number, but the right way, then it will be an issue for those individuals or for those communities who are suggesting to these individuals that they should stay, not engage. It will be up to them to provide additional support as well. And we are going to make sure that we can process matters as quickly as possible because I'm not seeing taxpayers' money spent in this area in the quantum that we've seen in recent years.
Final brief question.
Thank you. Minister, I think Australia has developed the most successful program so far to control undocumented arrivals. It's been done by trial and error. And it seems that in many other parts of the world, especially in Europe, this is a continuing problem. My question is there any attempt by Australia to advise or to help or to promulgate the policies that we have developed, which are the only ones, as far as I know, that work, for adoption in other countries, including the EU, where this issue has been a major and continuing source of political tension?
Well, Joseph, it's a good question. Look, it's not for Australia to provide advice to other countries. If countries or bureaucrats seek the advice, then we're happy to provide the advice of our experience, and some countries have done that. There are important aspects of our model which have led to success, including the fact that we're an island nation, obviously, compared to a landlocked country. So there are different elements that couldn't be translated into another context. So, but yes, some countries have sought our advice. We've provided it and will continue to do that because, as we said before, 1.8 million people across the Mediterranean over the course of the last few years is a significant number, and there are 65 million in the world who are displaced today.
Minister, many thanks.
Thanks. Thank you.
Look, I know there are many more questions and comments in the room, and unfortunately we just couldn't get to all of them. We got to over 35 minutes of them. Look, I think I'll be very brief. There are a lot of people here. Minister, that's a very impressive performance tonight. You spoke for over 20 minutes without a note. You took over 35 minutes of questions and covered all areas, and you dealt with agreements and disagreements. And I think there's one thing all of us can say tonight, that none of us will leave this room without knowing what you believe. And that's a very impressive. That's a very impressive performance. Congratulations.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.